Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kara Warren, and on today's show, we have Tom Perry, cheese sales manager of Shelburne Farms, a cheddar producer located in Vermont. And Tom has been a cheesemonger in the New England scene for many, many years and was a previous winner of the DZTA scholarship. And he's an overall good friend to everyone in the cheese industry, so I'm stoked. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Kara. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, I know. We have been really chatting about this one for a while, and it's my first episode for the fall-winter season, so I am just so pleased to have you as this first cool person on Cutting the Curd. I'm just over the moon about it.
Well, yeah, I'm excited to be back. The last couple of times, all my previous times, I've been here to talk about the Daphne Zeppos Teaching Endowment, whether it be as a recipient or to promote people applying. But this is nice to talk about Shelburne Farms.
Yeah, and I mean, we're going to talk about you a little bit too, but I think let's start with what we were just saying. Let's start with Shelburne Farms, because I feel like it's a leading cheddar producer of Vermont, and it has multiple levels to it. It's not just a cheddar producer, but I think it's better if you sort of give us an overview about it and its mission, because there's just so many facets to it that I would love the listeners to learn about.
Yeah, there are definitely a good number of levels of the complexity, as we like to call it. We say engage with the complexity of Shelburne Farms. And definitely cheddar production is one of the more tangible assets that we're known for producing. But the primary goal, or the primary focus, rather, of Shelburne Farms is actually sustainability education. Our mission is learning for a sustainable future. And what that means is, you know, we're not only learning how to become a more sustainable enterprise and operation, but we're also encouraging others to learn for a sustainable future. And, you know, the journey that we took to get where we are is pretty interesting, and I'm happy to share that story if you're so inclined.
Oh, yes. That was the follow-up question. I was going to ask you exactly that, like, what has inspired it, and what is, like, the background on this? Because I've been to the property, to Shelburne Farms, and it's gorgeous, but it's obviously of another time. And I feel like we should start from the beginning then and explain that to kind of build up to where Shelburne is today. So if you don't mind, I'd love to review that.
Yeah. So Shelburne Farms started in what we would consider its you know, modern or you know, modern iteration as a Vanderbilt family summer estate that has been converted into the sustainability education campus. And basically the initial background, you know, not counting, you know, the previous, you know, indigenous occupants of the land and, you know, the European colonization of the Americas, starts in the mid-1880s after the death of Billy Vanderbilt, who was the oldest son of Cornelius Vanderbilt, who basically ran all of the Vanderbilt enterprises that were part of, you know, the industrial age and the robber baron age and the gilded age. And he died in 1885. He basically doled out the largesse of his family fortune to his, I believe, 8 children. And the youngest daughter was a woman named Lila Vanderbilt. She married a doctor named William Seward Webb. And they, William was employed in the Vanderbilt, you know, family businesses. So he was tasked with finding railroad routes from New York into Canada through upstate New York and Vermont. And while he was up here in Vermont, he really fell in love with the area, and he set up, you know, smaller homes, or when he would bring him and his family up to the Burlington area, and that's where they would spend their summers. Whereas, you know, Lila's brothers and sisters were in Newport, or, you know, in the Jersey Shore, or in upstate New York. So when Billy died in 1885, Lila was given a $10 million inheritance in 1885 money. And
That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. So yeah. I always say to folks, to give people an idea of the kind of money we're playing around with, the entire operating budget for the state of New York in 1885 was $9 million. So
I love that. Okay, fantastic. I love that.
So they had some walking around money. Yeah. And what they did was, through a series of real estate agents, they purchased up, I believe, 32 individual farms in the town of Shelburne. They used different real estate agents to kind of coalesce this one ginormous property on the shores of Lake Champlain. And they turned it into their summer getaway. Half of the property was for them to use and enjoy. And then the other side of the property was a working farm. They called it a working model farm. And what they did was they built these impressive, you know, not quite Victorian, but definitely Gilded Age structures that were used for farming. If, you know, anybody that's been to Shelburne Farms, one of the first things they comment or, you know, notice is the incredible and beautiful large buildings. And, you know, the majority of those were used for, you know, practical agricultural operations. And
I mean, I love it. I think it's very much like, it's like a lot of turrets and a lot of shingles. And then it's just, yeah, I mean, it's if anyone is listening to this right now and has a moment, Google Shelburne Farms and look at it visually, because it's very impressive. It's very picturesque. Anyway, go on, Tom.
A lot of folks will call it the Hogwarts of cheese.
I wasn't sure if that was in place or not. I held my tongue on that because I was like, you know, I don't know if I should call it Hogwarts. It is very much a Hogwarts of cheese, though. That's fantastic. Okay,
totally.
Cool. We agree.
Fewer witches and wizards, but definitely a lot of magic going on. What they wanted to do with this property was they wanted to be an example of how the, you know, progressive science and agricultural innovation that was being developed in this time frame could be used to improve, you know, outcomes in terms of yield and animal husbandry and all these other facets that were, you know, basically rudimentary to human survival and endeavor and all that. So they would bring in like the most recent, you know, agricultural innovations. Like if an animal is sick, they would bring in the best vets from either New York or Boston. They'd share this knowledge with the local populace.
Really always been educational from the beginning, actually.
In a way, or at least there was like a mutual aid kind of facet to it. You know, maybe there was some money and profit.
Maybe it wasn't as honest as we're trying to keep it today.
well, maybe not as altruistic. Let's say that. I don't think there was any skullduggery by any means. But they tried doing that, and what they were actually hoping to do, their primary interest was in horses. And in the 1880s, you know, investing in horses sounds like a wonderful idea because everybody's using horses for transportation and for, you know, plowing the fields and what have you. So, you know, And I forget if we brought you to this building, but there's another building that is a little bit deeper into the property called the Breeding Barn.
And I think it is under construction at the moment. But I will get there one day. I have faith. But yeah, go on. It's impressive nonetheless. It's if you can describe it for the listeners.
And so the Breeding Barn is in the southern acres of the property, and it was for 40 years the largest freestanding wooden structure in the Western Hemisphere for like 40 years. So if you've been there, it's ginormous. It's huge. And basically it was built so that they could breed what I consider or what I've always called a more fuel efficient horse. They wanted to crossbreed the Hackney horse, which was used for conveyance in the New York area, with the Morgan horse, which is native to Vermont. Basically build a smaller statured horse, smaller statured horse with literal more horsepower, but would produce less waste. So in a way it was, again, like kind of, you know, tailored with in sustainability, like, you know, how can we produce this more efficient animal that takes in less feed and produces less waste and uses up less space? So I guess it's always been kind of the DNA of the of the property.
Yeah, I see that. So there's always been that mentality, at least. And now if we jump into today's scene at Shelburne Farms, I always think of it as a cheddar producer. I'm not sure which aspect we should talk. Should we talk about the cheddar production a little bit next?
I think we've got a lot of time to talk about the cheddar because, like, it all ties in together.
So go ahead. Tell me what's first you'd like to talk about. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously the first thing that we want to talk about is de-education. So, you know, on the property, even after, you know, the Gilded Age, you know, it was a conventional dairy farm. It had a sugar bush for maple syrup. And, you know, just as is the case today, you know, dairy farming isn't the lucrative enterprise that people make it out to be. And so there was an offer by the president of IBM to purchase the entire property so that he could develop it and then have the old Shelburne house for his property. And then the rest of the property would be turned into like subdivisions and residential areas. But there was always the cows and the sugar bush, and the kids who are now running the organization, their dad came to them and they said, you know, please don't sell this property. We're going to find to make it work. And for whatever reason, their dad said, okay, fine, do it. And what they did was they really embraced the environmental and ecological movements that were taking hold in the late 60s and early 70s. And they started doing summer camps and, you know, basically nature walks, stuff that I think, you know, we being, you know, in 2023, take for granted that there was just, you know, that there are just always these appreciative elements of nature, and more living in harmony with nature. Whereas, you know, there is always such a strong desire to like kind of conquer nature. Shelburne Farms, they started doing these summer camps and like taught people about all the plants and like all the birds and like how all of this ties into like a intertwined and, you know, interwoven ecology that we all need to live and prosper, because otherwise there could be disastrous consequences to man and beast. And but we've grown from just doing summer camps to now doing, you know, all this educational outreach to, you know, yes, we'll have school programs that will come in, but we'll also have educators from all over the world that will come through and take courses on how they can teach sustainability in their own locales, whether it's, you know, on a state, you know, city, county level, or on a national level with some of our international students.
Oh, wow. So that's very interesting that you guys have become like a blueprint for others. I didn't realize that. That's very cool.
Yeah.
So basically then you have the cheese making, you have the sustainability education. Does that mean you guys have like a tasting room then for people to come into and check things out? Or is it like, how do you get people in there to understand, or they seek you out. Basically, it sounds like people are seeking you out. How does it work best for Shelburne right now?
So people seek us out. We're you know, open to the public, you know, because we do have all this land and property and building. And when people do come to the farm, you know, during the high summer season, they can take a tractor ride up to what we call the farm barn, which is the main barn that people associate the property with. And there they can engage with, you know, various farm animals. They can engage in activities like hand milking or machine milking a cow. They can learn about sheep and they can, you know, engage with chickens. But then we literally have an area called the Hub, which is our cheese making viewing area, and we'll also have a member of on staff where people can try a couple of varieties of cheddar that we have for sampling that day. And then in addition to that, at the main entrance, we have a welcome center, which is essentially our farm store, where we'll also sample other varieties of cheddar, and where people can try and buy our cheese.
Nice. So can you say like how many people are working at Shelburne Farms? And are there classroom opportunities, or it's just all in the field, right? It's really like it's in real life. It's not like a school, like a classic traditional way. It's more like, you know, hands-on learning all the time, like the 4-H programs, right? Or something like that.
I mean, it's a little bit of everything. It's definitely, you know, out in the field education. There's also, you know, dedicated areas of the farm that are used specifically for education. So we can have groups of, you know, 30 some odd people, you know, able to take a class and engage with our educators. And in addition to those, you know, field spaces and, you know, educational spaces on the property, we also send our educators out into the to various other organizations or schools. We have, since the pandemic especially, we've developed a pretty strong virtual education program that we didn't really have before, but now we're able to engage with twice to three times as many people as we were prior to the pandemic, which is actually really great. And people will seek us out because we're a designated hub on like the UN sustainability. There's a UN map that has all these organizations that are committed to environmental sustainability, and we're one of the hubs for the Northeast, so people will come and seek us out.
Oh wow, that's amazing! I'm gonna have to check that out. I had no idea that existed, and I'm kind of just learning. Every Cutting the Card episode I do, I'm sort of learning more and more about like sustainability and how people are approaching it, and you know, there's just so many challenges in getting to be more sustainable. I believe I saw online even like you have a person that deals with like carbon neutrality or carbon zero. I was like, wow, they're working on this. Like there's science on this, like so much science that I'm like terrible to talk about it. But I mean, how do you feel about that? Like carbon sequestering? I mean, am I saying that right? Is that something that you're aware of, and do you promote it in your cheese sales program, this kind of work that's going on at Shelburne Farms?
So we are definitely aware of the carbon sequestration, and we've basically got a goal to be carbon neutral by 2028. And, you know, it's hard to kind of throw that into a sales pitch when you're talking about cheese.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't like naturally roll off the tongue. Like, you know, in addition to the sharp buttery flavors that you're going to encounter with our cheddar, we're also sequestering thousands of tons of carbon.
Right. For those who are aware, I mean, you do sales in New England and Vermont. Maybe somebody's asking. But anyway, go on. Yeah.
So it's kind of like one of those like kind of bonus things. It's sort of like, oh yeah, we're like non-GMO verified and we're humane certified and we're doing all the sustainability work. And like, I think you kind of need to like be vague about it because like, I think if you get too into the details on what we're doing, like people just glaze over.
Yeah.
All the little components and all the little changes that we are making are, you know, pretty important to making us carbon neutral. And, you know, honestly, like the biggest thing that we've done is converting to no-till agriculture, which we did back in the 90s. We decided to do, Shelburne Farms used to be, you know, planted with corn and barley and, you know, the cover crops that you hear about in agriculture to restore, you know, the nutrients to the soil up until the mid 90s. And then we realized that every time we broke ground to plant these crops, we were releasing thousands of pounds of carbon that had been sequestered by the plants the previous summer back into the atmosphere. And that was kind of counterintuitive. So we've spent the past 30 some odd years restoring the 1,400 some odd acres that we have to either to basically native grasslands. You know, we've encouraged, you know, the native fauna to take hold and you know, proliferate over the past 30 years. So it's really cool that, you know, not only are we sequestering all this carbon, but we're encouraging, you know, the species that are native and beneficial to, you know, the landscape that we're occupying.
Yeah, and it's more beautiful too. So it's good for the world, and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing to do, right? Now, do the cows get to graze? How long do they get to graze on this beautiful land? Is it rotational grazing? Let's bring it back a little bit to cheese, because I love being environmentally friendly, but I want to talk cheese with you.
Absolutely. Yes.
So what's going on with the cows there? What breed is it? How long do they graze for? Tell me more about that.
So I guess the basic primer on our cheddar cheese is we're a farmstead cheddar producer. We're using our herd of brown Swiss cows. Brown Swiss, for those that may not be aware, are known for their hardiness, especially in you know, winter-like environments that we have here in Vermont. But they're also well-adapted to heat as well. So that's especially good to keep in mind in this era of climate change. And they're also known for their elevated levels of butterfat. So that will produce, you know, a slightly creamier texture in our cheddar than, say, what you might find from our peers that are using Holstein cows, which is still definitely the most common breed here in the United States.
Well, and I was going to ask you, Tom, like, I don't know many other farms with that breed of cow. Like, do you know any? You don't have to say them, but are there other farms? There's not that many, right?
There aren't. And, you know, I should know if there are a lot more.
No, but it makes you guys unique. That's my point about Shelburne and the milk going to that. That's what I'm thinking is one of the unique factors about Shelburne Farms. No,
no, absolutely. And I agree with you that I feel like in at least in terms of American cheesemaking, there aren't a lot of exclusively brown Swiss herds out there. I've been noticing like Jerseys are definitely a lot more common. And obviously Holsteins, but in terms of like, you know, specific, you know, more heritage breeds, I guess, I know Sam Frank would argue with me when he say Brown Swiss and Jersey aren't really heritage breeds, but,
to us they are. How about that? I'll give it to you and Sam, we can fight about it later.
Fair enough. You know, we're one of the few ones that are using brown Swiss and instead of the Holsteins. So,
they get to be outside for how long? Is it like most of the year? Because you were saying they're pretty hardy. Is it like 9 months out of the year you think they get to be outside, or is it?
No, like, because it's Vermont.
Yeah, it's freaking Vermont and its weather. You're right. I'm sorry. I gave too much time.
Yeah, you're too generous. But, you know, they have been able to stay out longer for the past couple of years. Like I think we traditionally would bring them in sometime around, you know, mid-October, because it would start, you know, either getting a little too ruddy out there or a little too cold. But now the cows can stay out until sometime in November, and then we'll usually keep them in one of the barns or close by during the months of December through April is the good barometer, and then releasing them back out onto the pasture in May. And to answer your question, yes, we do rotational grazing through different paddocks that we have on the farm.
No, that's the way to do it, though. And I mean, why not? And then, well, I'm trying to think, Tom, should we take a quick break before we go into like some cheddaring talk? I feel like let's just do a quick break for the sponsor. Hey, everyone, you're listening to Cutting the Curd. I'm Kara Warren. I'm here with Tom Perry, and we'll be right back.
This episode is supported by HRN business members selected by Will Studd. Will Studd is the host of Cheese Slices, a unique documentary series about artisan cheese. Over 62 episodes filmed across 20 countries over 2 decades are a fabulous resource for anyone who loves cheese. Visit willstudd.com, that's willstudd.com, to learn more and to see the hand-selected special range of quality cheeses from Europe. Selected by Will Studd supports HRN's creative, educational reporting and storytelling that drive conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren. I'm here with Tom Perry of Shelburne Farms. We're here to talk cheddar and cheddaring. And then we'll talk a little bit about Tom's life in cheese, because I feel like he's a mystery man and I need to know more. But let's first start off with Tom. Would you mind giving us, just because sometimes I like cheese 101, a quick run through on how cheddar is made at Shelburne Farms, if you don't mind?
Absolutely. So every day, one of our cheese team members goes down to the dairy, and they're going to pick up milk from the dairy, and we're going to transport it in a haul truck. And that milk is comprised of that morning's milkings and also the previous evening's milking. And they're going to drive it about a mile from the dairy over to the farm barn. And they're going to snake a hose through the wall and attach that to a milk pump. And then they're going to pump the milk into a stainless steel vat. That stainless steel vat holds about 7,000 pounds of milk. And it's interesting, and I only bring that up because, like, we kind of, you know, the vat kind of determines how large our herd is. Because if we are producing too much milk, it's going to overflow over the vat, right?
So, oh, I see where you're going. Yes. Oh, wow. Okay.
So because we only have the one facility, we only make one batch of cheese per day. And if we have more than 7,000 pounds of milk, then that means it's just going to slosh all over the place. And that's not a good scenario for anyone. So, you know, we're working in concert with the dairy team to make sure that, you know, they're not producing too much milk, but they are producing milk, you know, even during like non-traditional, you know, breeding times and you know, high milk production.
Okay.
So, yeah. So sorry for that little aside, but
no. Nobody likes spilled milk. That's what I took away from that anecdote. But yeah. So anyway, we fill the vat with milk
and we'll warm it up. So we'll warm up the milk and we'll add cultures and we'll then add the rennet. We'll then cut the curd.
I had to giggle there.
Yeah, exactly. It's very name appropriate. Yep. And we attach paddles on and we stir the curd for about an hour and a half. And, you know, this is pretty common in not only cheddar production, but in most cheese production. I found, and I think you could probably agree that, like, you know, most cheese starts with like about the same 4 steps, give or take, you know, and then it kind of goes into the different directions. So once we're done stirring the curd, we're actually going to drain all of that whey out, because, you know, with the coagulation of the milk, you've separated the solids from liquids. And then once all that whey is drained out, we're going to form a couple of banks on either side of that stainless steel vat. And you know, all that curd wants to do is just knit back together and kind of form this solid mass. So what we're going to do is we're going to, you know, use that to our advantage, and we're going to have these solid masses of curd. But then we're going to cut those masses of curd into bread loaf-sized, you know, pieces loaves? Coagulated curd loaves is a wonderful way to describe it. And yeah. We're going to start stacking them on top of each other. And this is a literal cheddaring process where we're taking these large masses of curd and we're using basically the force of gravity and the weight of the curd to expel even more whey. And even though this is a step that is associated with cheddaring, mm-hmm. it isn't required to make cheddar in the United States.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
So according to the FDA, really all you need to be considered a cheddar is hit certain moisture targets and have certain acidity levels. There's no single established, production method that has been prescribed to define what a cheddar is.
I'm glad that you're here to explain this because I actually didn't know that. So thanks for sharing that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cheddaring. Yeah.
And so this is the traditional cheddaring that was developed by Joseph Harding back in England in the 1840s, give or take, and was kind of spread throughout England and then found its way to the Americas. And that's kind of the traditional method that was adopted for many years before large-scale industrialization of cheese production. We're gonna go through this cheddaring process. It's gonna go from this big, bread-sized loaf of curd, and it'll essentially start to stretch out and get pressed down, and it'll look like if you're familiar with what whole slabs of bacon look like, a whole pork belly that's been cured and unsliced. It'll end up looking like that and be about the same thickness and length. Once that's, reached its target acidity, we'll run it through the mill. And basically that's where the cheese curds that you think of for poutine or squeaky Wisconsin cheese curds, that's what you're producing. And they're about, a couple of knuckles on your index finger.
Yeah, I like to think cheese doodle size. And that's what comes to mind when I think of it. But, knuckles work too. Whatever you say, Tom.
cheese doodles is a little more, universally accepted form of measurement.
It's a form of measurement. Anyway, okay. So we have our cool curds, the squeaky curds. And what happens next then?
We're going to add salt because without salt, cheese is very, very bland. It's just cooked milk. And... basically cheddar is one of the few cheeses, if not the only cheese that is, salted directly, as you're probably aware, a number of cheeses get brined.
Yeah.
There are other cheeses that get dry salted. Cheddar is one of the few cheeses where salt is directly added into, the curds and, as part of the manufacturing process. We're going to add that in three doses because what you're doing is you're essentially shocking the curd and you're expelling more whey. And if we threw all the salt in it at once, all that salt would literally get washed down the drain. Mm-hmm. So this allows us to retain salinity and continue to expel more moisture. And then we're going to put it into 40-pound forms and we'll press it overnight. And the next morning, one of the cheese team will come through and they'll vacuum seal it and put it in a box and they'll let it do its thing for anywhere from 6 months to 3 years here at Shelburne Farms.
Well, and then it's truly your baby because then it's time for you to sell it to the world. It's Tom's cheddar cheese. It's Tom Shelburne Farms cheese. Get it out there, kid.
Exactly. I'm kind of coordinating all these cheese debutante balls, so to speak. So,
are you? I need to be invited to one. Let me know. I want to know, what should I wear to the cheese debutante ball?
That's more of a Tania Darlington kind of activity give her full credit.
All right. Also, let's give a quick shout out. Tania is doing a cheese ball in Philadelphia sometime in October. If you like that sort of thing, go look her up. She's awesome.
we'll put some cheddar in a prom dress and send it on down.
Sounds fun. Well, this also goes to another point. You do kind of run a debutante ball. You run the Midnight Mongers for ACS. that's sort of the closest thing we get to in a debutante cheese ball, I think. I mean, how much fun is that for you? And what would you love to see next at the Midnight Mongers?
Well, so you're at ACS. In Des Moines, yeah?
Yes, of course. Always.
Yeah. So I do have to say, so for those that aren't aware, Midnight Mongers is something that we started back in 2018 in Pittsburgh at ACS as kind of it was hoped to be more of like a Moss Story Hour kind of event. I think that's what we originally intended. Like, we want to have people like get up and share stories. But then it just turned into like cheese parody karaoke. And and like, people didn't care about like, or they weren't as interested in like, you know, our kind of stories and how we wanted to engage that way. People just wanted to hear funny cheese songs. So we did that at ACS in Pittsburgh and Richmond, and then obviously had the pandemic. And we reignited it in Portland and for ACS. And then it had always been, you know, traditional karaoke DJ, but in Des Moines we had a live band, and I was really against a live band because I was like, oh man, like, you got people that are gonna be like nervous enough about singing in front of people that they may or may not know or that they do business with, and like, and then you're going to compound it by adding a live band.
Yeah, that would scare the shit out of me.
Yeah. I felt the same way you did. I was completely wrong. People loved the live band. So I really feel like there's no going back.
Oh my goodness.
To that.
So are we going to do it? So this is my only thing. This is my only super small critique, and you can hate me forever for bringing this up, but can it be in darker spaces? I feel like hotel lighting is just not my favorite. It's the only detail I would love changed about Midnight Mongers, because everything else I love about it. I just want the lighting to be better. That's about it.
Yeah. So I feel like actually they did a pretty good job in Des Moines in terms of like ambiance, you know. Mm-hmm. It may not have been like dark enough for everybody's liking, but you know, it definitely had a good kind of loungy vibe. But
this is your mission for Buffalo. For yes. Just like for Kara Warren to show up, it needs to be dark. Right. That's all I care for.
I might get you a custom blindfold.
That's what I want. Okay, cool. Well, now I also need to bring it back to who you are as a person, because Tom, I think like you're one of the coolest, most awesome people to meet in the cheese world. And I don't actually know your origin story. I just know you as this awesome Tom Perry who sells Shelburne Farms cheddar cheese. Like, where and when did you start in cheese? Let me know more about that.
Yeah, so my origin story is pretty bland in the sense of I think I got into cheese the way a lot of the best people got into cheese. And thank you for those kind words, by the way. That means a lot. You know, I think we've known each other for about a decade.
A decade plus, Tom, but I don't want to age us too much. Anyway. Yeah.
And honestly, like, I got started by working at Formaggio Kitchen, and everybody thinks I was a cheesemonger at Formaggio Kitchen. I was not. I was actually part of the catering team there. And obviously, for those that are familiar with Formaggio Kitchen, it's one of the world's best cheese shops. And I say that without hyperbole. Like, it is one of the standards, I feel, for what a cheese shop should be and can be in terms of the way that they engage with customers and the way that they seek out all these amazing products. And I was there, you know, making tuna salad and, you know, chicken salad for the deli counter. And we'd have to do these catering platters, these cheese platters. And I'd go up to the cheesemongers and I'd say, hey, I need some cheese for this platter. And they're like, okay, here you go. And as I got these cheeses, that's how I was engaging with cheese. And I would try them, and I'd be like, oh, I like this. And, you know, we got a pretty decent discount, like a 20% discount. So I'd buy little pieces of cheese and I'd try different ones to get more familiar with it. But I was way in over my head. And I left Formaggio to work at a couple of restaurants in Boston. And then I moved down to the Providence area, and I was a chef actually at a daycare facility, the first daycare facility in the United States, in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And I was going nuts making, like, you know, chicken nuggets and, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and mac and cheese for, you know, toddlers, but you know, it was a very rewarding job, but it's just sort of like, I missed that connection to fine food and fine dining. Mm-hmm. And there was a store called Farmstead that was on the east side of Providence, and they were doing a pretty big expansion of their retail space and their restaurant space. And they needed more cheesemongers to kind of fill in during these expanded hours. And I said, well, I don't really want a full-time job. I really like what I'm doing, but you know, I'd like to be connected to this. And they're like, yeah, sure. And because I had that experience at Formaggio, and I knew the owners and all that, you know, that helped get me in the door. And you know, I would go in on the weekends and I'd sell cheese. And every time I'd go in, I'd be like, okay, what do you want me to sell? What's new? Can you tell me about this cheese? And that's how it went. Like, I just tried all these different cheeses. And eventually it got to the point where I was responsible for doing all of the domestic cheese ordering for Farmstead. And this was just at the moment when places like Jasper Hill and like Green Mountain Blue Cheese and
Cato Corner. It was just a good time. That's like the ultimate time right there, you know?
Exactly. And I had to call these places directly. And, you know, I formed all these like really strong relationships with it was back in the day when like Mateo would order answer the phone at Jasper Hill and be like, oh, I'll put you through to sales and away you go.
I love it.
So I took that and, you know, but from there I wasn't satisfied with just selling cheese. I wanted to learn. I thought I wanted to be a cheesemaker. Right? And I think every cheesemonger in their life has that inflection moment of like, I can make cheese, you know, mm-hmm. I can make really great cheese and then people can sell it or I can sell it. And I actually spent a year and a half at Cato Corner Farm as an assistant cheesemaker and like their market and farm store cheesemonger. And it was there that I learned that I actually don't want to be a cheesemaker.
Yeah.
And it's not because of anything that they did. It's just sort of like, you know, it's very clear that a lot of cheesemaking is, you know, dishwashing and sanitation and all that. And that is not what I wanted to do.
No, you need to be out in the world. Exactly. You know, if you're extroverted, it's yes, I get that. So did you go to Shelburne right after Cato? Is that, or am I missing a thing in between?
No, I was out in Chicago, for a couple of years. My ex-wife and I, she was from Chicago and she wanted to go back. And I was like, I like Chicago.
Yeah.
But
Vermont got you back. That's the thing. Yeah. I know you were out. That's what it's starting to come back to me now. You were out there for a little bit, but then Shelburne found you. And now you're living your best life in Vermont, I think you are. I mean,
yes. It's hard not to live your best life in Vermont. I am definitely very happy to be back in Vermont. Vermont is definitely home, and it's definitely where I'm going to be for a long, long time, if not the rest of my life.
It's so beautiful. Especially by the lake there. It's so beautiful. So we're almost done with this episode. I just want you to review real quick for the listeners, what type of cheddars exist for sale and how can they find them if they're looking to buy them?
Sure. So all of the cheddars that we produce at Shelburne Farms are raw milk cheddars made from our own herd of Brown Swiss cows or Farmstead. We're non-GMO. We're humane certified, and we have a whole lot of sustainability practices going on. We've got our six-month cheddar, our one-year cheddar, two-year cheddar, and a three-year cheddar. Those are our common age profiles that you can find. Primarily in the Northeast, but, you know, scattered throughout the country, all the way down to like the Mid-Atlantic and out in pockets on the West Coast and in the Midwest and down in the Deep South. And those come in anywhere from half pound to 40 pound formats.
Do you do a smoked cheddar too, or am I making that up?
We do a smoked cheddar and we also do a cloth bound cheddar. So.
Oh, yeah. Duh. You know, it's been a while since I've had the cloth bound, but I am partial to the 2-year. That's what I used to buy because I love it. It's a great profile.
And that's what most people know us for. The 2-year cheddar is what we consider to be, you know, the classic New England Vermont cheddar cheese profile with that like really intense forward acidity or sharpness, if you will. And then little wave of minerality in the middle and this nice little sweet uptick on the back end. It's really fantastic, and it's one of my favorites. My personal favorite is the 6 month cheddar.
Oh, I like that. Was insider knowledge. Okay, go on. Yeah,
that was the last cheese of ours that took a ribbon at ACS back in 2018. And you know, it's not a cheese for somebody that's looking for something that's gonna like really stun them. It's more remarkable in its simplicity and its nuance. You know, it's got what I consider to be, you know, the tangible fundamentals of what we are as an organization. It's got this nice buttery aspect to it, like kind of like buttered popcorn or buttered bread. And I attribute that to the herd of brown Swiss cows that we've got, which have that elevated level of butterfat. And then it's also got this grassy element to it too, because we are a pasture-based, you know, dairying operation. And, you know, that really comes through in the milk. It's not just kind of talk, you know, that there is a grassy note to it. So I feel it's like the most tangible representation of what we're doing at Shelburne Farms, without having to visit us.
No, that's perfect. And if you had to have, a last meal, you're stuck on an island, and one of the ingredients is Shelburne Farms cheddar. What would be the meal you would make? What's your go-to snack with this?
Oh, grilled cheese all day. Grilled
cheese. Wow. That was immediate. Yeah. I like that.
I don't need to think twice about it. I don't need to think twice about it because, you know, something that is really unique about our cheese is like it is so creamy because of the brown Swiss cows. And people pick up on that even in the more aged profiles. And like, it just melts wonderfully, in ways that I haven't seen other cheddars melt.
Oh, dang. I'm going to have to get me some of the Shelburne Farms cheddar and try this out. You know, you're the first guest, I think, to throw at me grilled cheese right away. Usually people go pretty over the top. This is totally a Tom Perry move, everyone. Grilled cheese. Straight up. That's it. Not messing around with anything.
Keep them guessing.
Totally. Tom, I just want to say thank you for coming on the show today. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me. This is wonderful. It's been far too long, and can't wait to see you again soon.
Yeah, definitely. All right, cool. Well, I'm just going to give everyone a little information about how to follow up. Hey, guys, if you want to find Tom on Instagram, he's at Thomas the Monger. If you're looking at Shelburne Farms, go to @ShelburneFarms or go to their website, shelburnefarms.org. Plus, you can follow us at Cutting the Curd and myself at Kara Warren. And please listen and subscribe to Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to your podcast. Also, don't forget to give us a 5-star review. We like those. We hope you give them to us. Helps us with the podcast world. Yeah. And thanks, and eat more cheese. Cheers.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.